17-1036 Nalco Company v. ChemMod. Mr. Farney, whenever you're ready, please proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Farney and I represent the appellant Nalco Company. This appeal is from a 12B6 dismissal and it is unusual in at least two respects. First, as the court knows, its review is de novo. The parties have agreed on that. But here it's de novo in literally one sense. It's unusual. In dismissing Nalco's complaint three different times below, the district court never held a single oral argument. So this is the first time Nalco has ever been afforded an oral argument to explain why its complaint does state a claim for infringement.
Well, you don't have to have oral argument to get due process.
That's correct.
Don't adequately explain it in your briefs, then that's up to the district court.
Agreed. It is unusual, however, and I think it led to the error, the reason that we're here. Without having that oral argument, the district court never really understood what our position was on infringement. So the issues we have here is, did he err in miscomprehending what our infringement position was? He never addressed either alternative theory and dismissed it for any reason that applied to those theories, as I'll explain. And then second, has ChemMod given us any reason to think otherwise?
Well, I'm actually trying to drill down on your infringement theories too. So your primary argument for direct infringement by the named defendants, or the originally named defendants, is based on the full-scale testing, right?
Correct.
All right, then I think one of the pieces of confusion is, are you relying on direct infringement by unnamed parties for purposes of your indirect infringement claims?
Yeah, so the direct infringement claim that we're relying upon and preserved here on appeal is that ChemMod and its affiliates that are named direct the process in the North Dakota facility, as we allege in paragraph 63 to 67 of our complaint, and control that process. And they've never denied that they do that. In their briefing below, in the 4AC briefing at page 5, and here on appeal, the only thing they say is the process is not covered by the claims, but they never say they control all those steps in the process. So that's a direct infringement act. As in conjunction with all their work in the commercial power plants, the commercial power plant operator is the one that actually injects the material into the flue gas and would be the direct infringer. So that's the underlying direct infringement for which we allege their inducing and contributory infringement, arises from.
Right, and I think that's where the confusion was. I think that the district court thought that you were assuming that it was the named defendants, the originally named defendants, who had to engage in the direct infringement before you could have any indirect infringement.
I think that's some of it. I also think the confusion, as we read the record, I think the confusion also led in part to some terminology confusion. The district court, in dismissing the First Amendment complaint, focused on the fact that ChemMod and its affiliates apply this MRSOR, the bromine precursor, to the coal outside the plant. And they use the term injection, a dual injection process. The MRSORB and the SSORB is a dual injection process on the coal outside the plant. In its complaint, Nalco had used that word injection, as ChemMod does, but then later said it's the injection of that treated coal with the MRSORB into the furnace where the flue gas is the infringing injecting step. But the district court, you can read at page 5 of his opinion in dismissing the 1AC, said applying or injecting this material out here on the coal cannot be injecting in the furnace, and therefore it's not plausible it's infringement. And never really understood that wasn't the infringing step we were talking about. The infringing step we were talking about was once you inject that coal with the MRSORB into the furnace, that is injecting the flue gas. We tried to clarify that. Nalco tried to clarify that in the Third Amendment complaint to make it clear that's the step we were talking about. And if you read the district court's opinion at page 6, it's quite clear he summarizes what we said, but then says, as I've already said, applying it to the outside, to these three places outside the plant, can't be injecting the flue gas. He never addressed the question of whether injecting into the furnace is injecting the flue gas. When you get to the Fourth Amendment complaint, you can really see the error has propagated. In the Fourth Amendment complaint, as the court knows, there's a dispute between the parties whether flue gas exists where Chembod's stuff is injected, or whether it's limited to the upper furnace region and beyond. Nalco, by the Fourth Amendment complaint, added a second alternative theory of infringement, that even if flue gas isn't where the injection, where the Chembod process was put into through the coal injectors, it is in the upper furnace region, and injecting it through the coal injectors will cause it to shoot up under pressure to that upper furnace region, and that is injecting within the meaning of the claim. The district court cited, summarized that position in page 5 of the dismissing the 4AC, and then said, I've already addressed this, in my opinion, with respect to the 3AC, which couldn't be true because we'd never alleged it till the for the Fourth Amendment complaint. And if you go back and look at the section he cites at page 6 of the Third Amendment complaint, he's again saying applying it outside the to the coal outside the plant is an infringement. So I don't think the court ever really understood that we were not accusing applying the material to the coal outside the plant as an act of infringement. What we were accusing was spraying that material, the bromine precursor, along with the coal into the plant is the act of infringement, either because at the point of the injection where the coal injectors are, there's flue gas, or even if you take the alternative position, the flue gas is in the upper furnace region, it gets to the flue gas.
Do you agree with the proposition that, that even if there are only limited obligations with respect to pleading, that one could plead themselves out of court by affirmatively making statements that would make it clear that there can't be infringement?
Conceptually, that could be true. You could say, my claim requires A, B, and C, and then go on to say they don't have C. That would be that could happen in the case. It didn't happen here. Here, the claim simply requires injecting bromine precursor into the flue gas. Chembod does not dispute that when they inject the treat, when the treated coal is injected into the furnace, that is injecting bromine precursor. The claim is a comprising claim, and as we said in our brief, and Chembod did not oppose this, that means that you, if you're injecting bromine precursor and coal along with it, that you are injecting bromine precursor. The only dispute between the parties is whether flue gas exists where that injecting is occurring. And we have two theories on that. And remember, at this stage, we're not, like your prior case, with a summary judgment, we're not here on a final judgment. We're simply whether we've stated a plausible claim for infringement for which we're entitled to have a fair hearing and a fair day in court. Let's look at both of these theories, and I'll take the second theory first. On the second theory, which as I pointed out, the district court never really addressed, the only argument Chembod has ever given for why that position is implausible, that injecting through the coal injectors causes it to flow under pressure to the upper furnace region where they say the flue gas is still infringement, is that it's implausible that thermal label material would get to the upper furnace region. They just simply say that. Their attorney says that, but there's no evidence of it. They cite no expert that says that. There's simply nothing in there. We say it does get there, and at a 12B6 stage, we should be, our position is accepted as true. But it's more than that. We showed you in the brief there's a Felsvang reference that was intrinsic to the to patent, cited in the patent, and at lines 39 through 50 of column 4 in Felsvang, it specifically talks about injecting a chlorine precursor instead of a bromine precursor. Same purpose, removing mercury from the gas. And if you want more precursor to be up beyond the upper furnace region, you can inject more into the furnace. So Felsvang clearly understands you can inject more precursor into the furnace to get it up above and shows that it's possible to get precursor up above even though you're injecting into the furnace. So we have one data point that our position is right, not just plausible, but right. They have no data point otherwise. It's simply at a 12B6 stage not possible to say that our position on the second theory is not plausible.
What about the district court's statement that as it relates to indirect infringement, you didn't adequately plead intent?
It's interesting. If you look at the court's opinion, he says two things. He says primarily that both as to inducement and contributory infringement, that the reason we don't meet those either of those is we have no underlying direct infringement for the same claim scope issue. He did make and almost a side reference that we didn't plead intent, but we pointed out that we did plead intent in paragraphs 108 through 111 of the Fourth Amendment complaint. And if you read those paragraphs, we clearly alleged intent, and at the 12B6 stage, that allegation of intent has to be accepted
well,
as true.
Well, the intent's only been relevant to the induced infringement, right? It's not relevant to the contributory infringement. And
correct.
You pled knowledge, and you said no no non-substantial, non-infringing uses.
That's correct.
And that should be sufficient for contributory.
That's correct.
Even if there were some flaw in the indirect for inducement.
That's correct. They're separate theories, and the only time he referenced that intent was with respect to the inducement. And as you can read, like I said, 108 through 111, that we did do so. And on contributory, the only reason he ever gave was the no infringement claims point to point. Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. Turning to the first infringement theory we had is that when they inject the bromine precursor along with coal using the coal injectors into the furnace, that is injecting the flue gas. We specifically alleged in paragraph 29 of our complaint the following. Coal combustion flue gas is present throughout the operating coal combustion furnace, including the site at which the Chem-Mod solution mixture is injected via coal injectors into the operating coal-fired power plant. We made that specific allegation at a 12B6 stage that needs to be accepted as true. But it's not just a bare statement that it needs to be accepted as true. There was intrinsic evidence at the time of the 4AC that supported our position. Claim 21 of the patent includes the phrase, where the flue gas is produced during combustion of coal. The point here is, what's going on here is you have coal that's been pulverized to the stage of basically talcum powder. It's being injected under pressure with this bromine precursor into basically a giant blowtorch. That's what's going on. And there's flue gas where that flame is occurring. And that's what this claim 21 is saying. Flue gas is produced during the combustion of the coal. The PTAB in reexamination found that flue gas is not limited to location or temperature, where temperature is essentially a proxy for location because it gets cooler as it goes up through the power plant. And particularly Madden, which was a point discussed by the Patent Office, is a reference we cited at page 32 of our opening brief to show you that the art clearly understands that when you're wanting to inject material into the flue gas, you can do so by injecting it in the upper furnace region or even further up, and it's confusing because up is downstream, but either using either term, you can inject it places there, but you can also, and this is the key in Madden, figure 2 of his patent on page 32 of our brief, you can also inject into the flue gas by putting the material in with the fuel and injecting directly in the furnace. Now, Madden says at column 4, lines 1 through 13, that is injecting into the flue gas just as much as injecting in the upper furnace region or at other places downstream. Now, if that's injecting the flue gas, and Nalco's position is what ChemMod's doing is injecting the flue gas, that's at least a plausible position that we have stated to for infringement, and we're entitled to move forward to a Markman hearing and the other proper process in the case. Now, what is ChemMod's response to this? They don't cite a single piece of evidence that says anyone in this industry thinks that coal combustion gas is called something other than flue gas, that it's called something down here and something else up here. They don't have anything like that. The only thing they cite is two sentences out of over 2,000 pages of file history from that Nalco in the re-exam brief to the PTAB, according to them, limited flue gas to something less than what it means in the art. You don't have to read all 2,000 pages to know that they're taking the sentence out of context. You have to read one page, page 6, where those statements are. There are three paragraphs on that page. Paragraph 1, Nalco says, the Orr patent claims and the specification do not limit flue gas to any location. Flat out says that. In the third paragraph, and continuing on to the next page, it says the Orr claims do not limit flue gas to any location. Now, ChemMod's entire case for why our first theory isn't plausible is that the middle paragraph somehow says something completely the opposite of what the first and the third paragraph say.
You're well into your rebuttal time. You want to make sure you save some?
I will. We showed you in the briefing that was not the case because particularly what those two sentences were talking about was the Madden reference and another reference. And as I've said, Madden clearly shows the material, the flue gas is in the area of the coal injectors where the injecting occurs. And with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay. Mr. Mark.
May it please the court, Richard Mark for the defendants. My colleague Joe Eval is with me at counsel table. Patent in this case claims a method for treating mercury containing flue gas by injecting a form of bromine into flue gas. the ChemMod process is categorically different from that. It involves applying chemicals to solids.
The problem here is that you know, I'm feeling like I'm back in the district court and that we're having a claim construction argument, one that never occurred below. So why are we discussing claim construction here on a motion to, when we're an appeal from a motion to dismiss?
What the district judge did appropriately in this setting was to apply the broadest plausible, broadest possible construction to the patent and say, is there anything, any way this can be read?
No.
He didn't apply a limiting reading.
If the district court wanted to do this on a motion to dismiss, what the district court should have said, I'm going to apply the construction that the plaintiff proposes and then see if there's no way there can be infringement. He can't choose among constructions when there's a debate over what the appropriate construction was without having a claim construction.
No choice was made by the district court because what the complaint did here, including by attaching as exhibits material of ChemMod and Arthur Gallagher, was to adopt as allegations of the complaint the defendant's description of its process. And that description shows clearly that the process is a different one than the method claimed in the patent.
Assuming
so those allegations,
accept your description of what the method claimed in the patent is.
It is not simply accepting the defendant's assertion in a disputed setting. What happened here was that the plaintiffs chose to incorporate and make part of their complaint ChemMod's description of what it does, including its understanding of what it does, which incidentally dooms the aspects of the indirect infringement case. But in terms of direct infringement and whether somebody, a non-party in this case, is directly infringing by adopting the thing that is attached as Exhibit E to the Fourth Amendment complaint, that PowerPoint that I'm sure the court has reviewed, that document was attached to every single complaint from the first complaint that was filed through the amended complaint, the first, second, third, and fourth. And that was the consistent description adopted as an allegation of what the ChemMod process is that the court could and should on 12b6 assume the truth of when it makes the determination of what the process is, comparing it to a patent that says we inject into flue gas. To do otherwise and to say, oh, we'll take anything here as the description, as the plaintiffs are urging on this appeal, would be to read the word flue out of the claim. And that can't be done. You can't just take coal combustion flue gas and turn it into coal combustion gas without changing fundamentally the meaning of the patent. As to certain other aspects of the argument that have already been made, I think there are some clarifications that are inevitable as a result of the way the matter has been litigated. As to these defendants, there is no direct infringement case left. It has been...
What about the testing allegation?
The testing allegation was first raised on this appeal in the reply brief. It was not raised as a matter in the appeal as a basis for changing the judgment.
The judge's obligation is to look at the complaint. I mean, they allege infringement through testing. Are you saying that it's not in the complaint?
They do have allegations in the complaint, but it is the obligation of the appellant to say what it wants to have changed about the judgment in its brief on appeal. There is no argument in the plaintiff's principal brief on appeal that the testing allegations
waiver
are
a
basis.
Waiver is at the discretion of the appellate court. So why don't you, I understand your waiver argument, but why don't you move beyond it on the assumption that you may not prevail on that. So why don't you move beyond it and tell us, do you have a response on the merits to Judge O'Malley's question about the North Dakota testing, or is your only response to that waiver?
The principal response to that is that the process as it is performed is not infringing. As even raised in the reply brief, however, the testing allegations don't go to all of the defendants in this case. And that, even as they describe it in the reply brief. So there are a number of parties that aren't covered by that.
It doesn't have to go to all defendants.
No, it doesn't, but certain parties...
And that was part of the confusion here, is that you know, there are separate claims. Some defendants are accused of some things, others are accused of other things. Some defendants, direct infringers are not even listed in the complaint. I mean, you don't have to have every single allegation apply to every single defendant.
That's true. The way the complaint was originally structured, however, that is what the plaintiffs attempted to do, and what they have been doing since then is retreating in certain ways to try and preserve some aspect of the claim. A fundamental flaw in...
Well, when they filed their complaint, in fairness, the direct infringement claims were governed by Form 18. Yes.
That is true.
Yes. And the district court just ignored that.
Not so. Because this complaint, by attaching additional materials and going beyond what Form 18 allows as essentially a safe harbor for a certain type of complaint, the plaintiffs eschewed that from the get-go.
You seem to think there's some smoking gun. I've got your PowerPoint right here, 2381. Is that the page you think is some smoking gun attached? Because I did review this, but I didn't see anything that pleads them out of court the way you seem to be suggesting. So it might help me, at least, if you would point with specificity to the things that they attach to their complaint, which you think make their complaint implausible on its face.
Sure.
I mean, the only thing I think you could be talking about is 2381, but I could be wrong.
Well, 2381, of course, shows first, and that is the drawing of the PowerPoint, which shows where the only activity these defendants engage in occurs. It's in the green oval, omitted from the brief as we otherwise noted. But that shows where the entirety of the activity of these defendants occurs. And that's where the application and so on goes on.
So they're injecting, so they say, I don't believe any of this is privileged. Is there anything I'm about to say that's under a protective order? I'm about to say where it's being injected.
Go right ahead.
All right. So their argument is that it's being injected into what, a combustion chamber? Is that a fair way to characterize that?
That it's in other words, if you go to the right of the green oval on 2381, to where it's pointing to the boiler furnace, that's where they say that occurs.
Okay. But where is it being injected? Where is the CMS, right? Is that what CMS? Is that what it's called?
The chem mod solution,
yeah,
is the description of the process. What the complaint alleges to be the chem mod solution mixture,
okay,
is refined coal that has chemicals added to it.
Where is the thing injected?
That is to the right in the boiler furnace. The other place to look for this, Your Honor, is if you look at paragraph 27 of the fourth amended complaint. There is another drawing there, a schematic, that illustrates...
Where can I find that? Fourth amended complaint, I guess, is at 2102. You want me to look at paragraph 27? All right, 2116. So what is it you want me to see about this? This one's sort of less clear than the pretty one.
Than the pretty one, yeah.
2381, it's color-coded.
So if... There's a structure, you see reagent injection options, and there is a structure with three little arrows in it that says coal injectors.
Which page is this?
This is 21, I have it on 2116 of the appendix.
Okay.
The three little arrows inside the yellow box that say coal injectors.
Yes,
right?
And that structure there, that's, and you see above coal injectors it says furnace.
Yeah.
That's where they are saying that happens. The blue lines that go to the left of that show where the MERSORB is mixed in with the coal. And what they're alleging is that the coal injectors in the furnace, that is where the injection step is alleged to occur. And to differentiate that
where is it that you think the flue gas is?
The flue gas, by admission of Nalco, if you look to the top of that box where the coal injectors are, that's where above the combustion zone in the superheater would be. And what I would point to...
So you think it's in the upper part of the furnace. That's where you think the flue gas is.
Sure. And so that's not just me saying that.
They're injecting something here.
Yes.
What is wrong with their argument that simple physics would suggest when you inject something into a combustion chamber, it's going to rise up? Maybe wrong. Maybe you'll be able to prove it wrong. But why isn't that enough at the complaint stage to give them an infringement allegation?
Because the admission that they made in the reexamination proceeding reads like this.
Oh, so now you want me to claim disclaimer. So now, in order to save you at the 12B6 stage, I not only have to go this deep into the facts, but I have to figure out whether they're just disclaimer on a claim construction that the district court didn't actually make. Because that's certainly not accepting their view of
right.
claim construction. You said he picked the broadest possible view, right? But you want me and are going to require me to agree with a disclaimer or a lexicography in prosecution in order for you to win, even though there was no hearing on any of that, very little briefing below on it, and yet that's how far I have to go to get you out of 12B6?
I wouldn't treat it as a disclaimer, Your Honor. The way I'd characterize it is an admission by Nalco to the Patent Office in the following context. They're facing an argument in the PTAB.
Did they attach the re-exam to the complaint?
No.
Okay, so how does that get in?
I think it can come in by judicial notice, and we did. They have actually, I think for purposes of the motion to dismiss, it can come in by judicial notice. And what
was
they
there a motion for judicial notice?
No, there was not. What they said in that, and we quoted it to the district court, and indeed this has gone back and forth in the district court, was the following. Accordingly, the prior art is quite clear and consistent in its teachings that flue gas refers to combustion gases which reside in the flue, the region of a coal combustor from above the combustion zone through the particulate collection system. That's an admission by them in the following context. In a patent office proceeding where they are resisting an attempt to limit their patent to a lower temperature zone, where they are broadening it out and saying under the broadest reasonable construction here.
Some sort of admission in order to get you out from underneath what is really a factual question about what was or wasn't relinquished in this course of prosecution history is quite novel. Do you have any case that you can point me to where we have defined statements in the prosecution history like this as an admission that would be treated under a different standard than, say, disclaimer, and yet still affect claim scope?
I don't have a case on that.
Because I feel like you just made it all up.
Well, the statement that they made that in...
No, the legal standard.
Yeah.
The legal proposition or test that you'd like for me to adopt feels quite novel. That there's an admission that was made during prosecution, which somehow informs the scope of the claims. But it's not a disclaimer. It's something different than a disclaimer, according to you.
Certainly, information from the patent office proceedings can be brought to the attention of the district court as appropriate to illuminate the meaning
right,
of the
and
patent.
And there's a dispute over what that statement actually means, right?
It has been asserted. If
just
you
to be
re-
clear, you could be right at the end of the day, but my problem is... Mm-hmm. You're trying to get me to swallow all this at 12B6, you know, and that's just so early, and I don't even see all this flushed out in the lower court's opinion.
Mr. Mark, wouldn't it have been better if we'd had claim construction proceedings before the district court? I mean, how? And this really just illuminates it. You've got to have claim construction, because your whole position seems to be premised on a particular claim construction.
Well, there is no, we do not say that the court defined or said this is the limitation and what the claim actually means. Indeed, if you look at paragraph 21 of the Fourth Amendment complaint, the plaintiff points away from claim construction. They say in paragraph 21, as explained in the patent, coal combustion flue gas is coal combustion gas. They say, don't look outside. I'm sorry.
One of my biggest problems here is that this is a district that has local patent rules. Instead of following those local patent rules and finding out exactly what the infringement contentions are and pinning them down and going through that analysis, you had 2 years of pleading and briefing on motions to dismiss. And you're asking us to apply an incredibly strange standard on a motion to dismiss. Instead of just saying, Judge, we can get this all sorted out within the first 60 days, and let's just get the infringement contentions in place, let's put them to their test, let's figure out what the claim construction is. I mean, instead you've got us, after 2 years of pleadings and briefing on pleadings, now we're supposed to go behind everything to try to throw this case out. It feels like you're asking us to conduct a bench trial.
I know my time is up. May I give a brief response to that? The parties actually did go through exchanging infringement contentions, and NALCO attached to the second amended complaint, the third and the fourth, its infringement contentions, which is why certain exhibits are reiterated in the appendix multiple times. In that, again, what NALCO did is adopt and readopt the defendant's materials explaining what the ChemMod process was. All of the material extrinsic to that they could have used to allege facts, which they didn't do, to explain why the process comes within the patent, they first put in on reconsideration, a point where, at that point, they are making new arguments, new facts, new law that the district judge appropriately didn't consider at that point. The Madden reference, for example, comes under that rubric, never brought to the attention of the district court. We submit that the judgment below was correct and should be affirmed. After having several times to plead the complaint, they failed to state one, and it should be dismissed with prejudice. Thank you.
Mr. Farney, you have rebuttal time, but Judge O'Malley really put forth the best rebuttal you could have possibly put forth. Do you want to come to the podium?
I would like to.
If you really want to, go ahead. I feel like you've got nowhere up. You can't go up very much more.
I understand that. I was only going to point out that Judge O'Malley, that we did ask the district court and point out the local patent rules and say that if we had the opportunity to follow those rules and have a Markman hearing, that that's where this should be fleshed out. I think we've addressed the other points counsel raised about the exhibit and the flaws with the prosecution history in our briefs and my previous arguments. So I'll just let us stand at that unless the court has any questions.
Okay, I thank both counsel for their argument, and the case is taken under submission.